It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. Thanks for joining us here today. As we get set to ring in the new year, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews from 2014. Coming up later, an author makes the case that positive thinking has been a powerful influence in American culture, and he says one simple idea reshaped the way we think.
First, a look at the rise of generic drugs in the United States. In pharmacies and drugstores all across the country, brand-name drugs and generics sit side by side, and they're pretty much the same thing, right?
Well, the answer is more complicated than we might think, and there's a lot more to these drugs than what immediately meets the eye.
We spoke to physician Jeremy Green back in September. He's an associate professor of medicine and the history of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. He's also the author of the book Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. I started by asking him to provide a little bit of history on generic drugs and when they really started to hit it big in the healthcare market.
Well, what shocked me as a historian of 20th century medicine is how recent the generic drug industry is. If you look back in the 1960s, you know, beginning of the decade, fewer than 10% of all prescriptions are filled generically in the pharmacy. And there's even a lot of debate about whether there even is such a thing as a generic drug. There's no companies that call themselves generic drug companies in 1960. By the year 2010, more than 80% of all prescriptions filled in the United States are filled generically. And the generic drug industry is really a major one of the dominant forces in the drug market worldwide at this point.
And in the introduction of your book, you've got two stories, one of a former FDA official and one of a scientist looking for differences between generic and name brand versions of some thyroid medications. I wonder if you could tell us about those.
Sure. It's something I learned along the course of doing research for this book, that there are a number of really human stories, many tragedies involved in both sides of the problem of generics. And when I say both sides of the problem, I mean the question of whether generics are really the same as brand name drugs, and any attempt to call them different has been a form of marketing smokescreen that prevents people from having access at affordable cost to medicines they need. Or on the other hand, whether generic drugs are not the same, and actually attempts to call them the same is a artificial stamp of government or insurance-based similarity or exchange, which produces cost effectiveness but at risk to human life. And I begin the book with two specific stories. One is of a gentleman named Marvin Seif, who I see as a real tragic figure. He was a career FDA staffer. He was the first person to be ahead of the FDA's division of generic drugs when that division opened up in the early 1970s. And you know, if you look all along, Seif pops up here and there in different points of the book. He was an early champion of the generic drug industry. He really believed that generic drugs were a way of taking the problem of excess pharmaceutical promotion out of medicine and producing higher value, more accessible medicine. But he becomes involved in a scandal in the late 1980s and early 90s that many within the FDA now remember as the worst scandal to shake the FDA in its entire history. And it goes something like this. A set of generic companies begin complaining to Congressman John Dingell of Michigan, who's heading the Congress Oversight Committee, that they believe that applications by some generic drug companies to the FDA are getting streamlined and getting passed really quickly, and that applications from other generic drug companies are taking forever. And an investigation begins turning up materials by finding incriminating documents in the trash cans of FDA regulators. There's a real cloak and dagger story here involving FDA regulators. Turns out that there's manila envelopes stuffed full of thousands of dollars of cash. They're being left on desks or in bathrooms in the Park Lawn office building in Rockville, Maryland. And what's happening is some generic companies are paying regulators to lose the applications of other companies. And there's a story of bribe and graft that emerges. And as part of it, it turns out that even though all generic drug manufacturers need to prove is that their drugs are the same as the brand name drug, they don't have to prove efficacy and safety, that some companies couldn't even do that, and they were outsourcing that material. And one of the things that turns up, and you know, stop me if I'm going into too much detail on this story.
Oh, go ahead.
One of the things that they turn up is there's a company here in Baltimore called Pharmacokinetics that does these studies. It's a study called bioequivalence, showing that not only that a generic drug has the same chemical as the brand name drug, but that it's absorbed into the body of human volunteers at the same rate, that it actually gets to where it needs to go. And so this company is doing similarity tests for generic firms. One of the companies that comes up in the inquest, Bolar, turns out that it had submitted two samples for a test of bioequivalence to show that its generic version of the Sandoz tranquilizer Melril worked the same. And when they looked at these two samples, one was supposed to be Bolar's, the other was supposed to be Sandoz's, they found that actually, if you looked really closely, the Sandoz drug was a circle and had a Superman-like S with a triangle, which is Sandoz's logo. And the Bolar version was the same shape, except it had no S. But if they looked closely under a microscope, they could find traces of that S, so that Bolar had actually basically just taken the original brand name drug, sandpapered off the logo, and sent it into the lab claiming it was their own.
Wow. So this is interesting, because this is a big question for people who take generic medications. Are they really the same? And I wonder where you got with that question. How similar do they have to be in terms of chemical composition and in terms of how they work in the body?
Well, it's a fascinating question. And, you know, I just want to say at the outset that as a physician, I prescribe generic drugs regularly in my practice. As a patient myself and as a parent, I both consume generic drugs myself and offer them to my family when they're sick. But that doesn't mean that generic drugs are identical to brand name drugs. And, you know, in a sense, one of the problems that emerged in the story of Marvin Seif, and one of the reasons he winds up going to prison, is that he didn't realize that his trust in this generic industry, which he believed to be in some ways an outgrowth of merely a virtuous form of public policy, could actually lead to shortcuts and graft. So one of the questions we have today, the FDA has reformed quite a bit since that scandal, but what are the standards that we have to give us confidence that these things are the same? And I can list a few of them just to help listeners think about what it's like in the present day. I mean, generic drugs are supposed to be the same, they're supposed to have the same active ingredients as the innovator drug, although inactive ingredients can vary, and we can talk more later about what it means to think of something as an inactive ingredient. They're identical in strength and dosage form and in route of administration. They're supposed to be used for the same purposes. They're supposed to be bioequivalent, the science of absorption that we talked about before. And they're supposed to meet the same batch requirements for identity, strength, purity, and quality. And they're also supposed to follow what the FDA calls good manufacturing practice regulations, meaning not only is that test batch supposed to be the same, but the something about the way the company produces its products should give you confidence that one batch is the same as another batch, that they keep up those good practices throughout. Now, one of the things we can talk about when we look at this is realizing that generic drugs are not identical. There's no claim that they're identical to brand name drugs. They're supposed to be similar. They're supposed to be same in the ways that we think matter. But there's a lot that goes on in the science and politics of what matters in drugs. And it's much more complicated than first appears.
So whose job is it then to vet whether or not the medication you're taking is the one that's most effective for whatever your health concern is, whether you should be taking the brand name drug or the generic drug? Now, does that burden fall to your doctor, or is that the pharmacist's job?
Well, at this point in time, Veronica, most state legislatures have decided that therapeutically equivalent drugs, as deemed by the FDA, can be substituted at the pharmacy by a pharmacist. These substitutions can happen based on insurance programs, or they can merely happen based on the practice of pharmacy. What I would suggest, though, is that question you're asking right now, who gets to decide whether you get a brand name or a generic version, is a live question that changes at different points in time over the 20th century. And in the beginning of the story of this book, the question is really unambiguous. It's the physician who decides. And there had been a wave of anti-substitution laws that had been passed in almost all 50 states, which made it illegal for a pharmacist to give a patient a generic version instead of a brand name version. This begins to change in the late 60s and the 1970s, and by the mid-1980s, all of those laws have been reversed and replaced by substitution laws, which actually mandate, in many cases, force pharmacists to give a generic version instead of a brand name version. And that historical change is part of a radical transformation in the nature of the doctor-patient relationship and how we look at health consumerism in America.
That's Jeremy Green, Associate Professor of Medicine and the History of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University. We're taking a look at the history of generic drugs and the role they play in today's healthcare system. And we'll pick up that conversation in just a moment.
First, we throw it over to the WPR newsroom with a look at some of today's top headlines. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about the history of generic drugs with Johns Hopkins Professor Jeremy Green.
And you can join the conversation. Do you take generic drugs? Why do you use them? Or do you want to stick with the brand name in some cases? And do you have questions about generic drugs or the industry or their history?
And we go to our phones right now. We've got Kate on the line in Madison. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Couple things. My own experience has been that my insurance company won't pay for the brand name. And so in some cases, I've had the choice of was I going to pay for it out of pocket, which is quite expensive, or go with the generic. I also have been told that for seizure control, that many neurologists have had problems with using generics, that they find the brand name is more effective and that the generic has caused some problems. And the other thing that I've been told, and I'd like your guests to comment, is that generics are allowed to be within a certain percentage of brand names, so let's say between 90 and 110% or something like that, and that they're allowed to be in a range and they don't have to be 100%.
Gotcha. Got the gist of your question there, Kate. And yeah, let's talk about that, Jeremy. For one thing, I want to start with her question about, you know, sometimes it seems as though the brand name works better, but someone, the insurance company perhaps, the doctor wants to prescribe generic, and that's what the consumer has to get. How is a consumer to navigate those waters?
So these are really important questions, and they're really hard to resolve immediately. So every consumer of a prescription drug is an N of one. And if we get back to the question about, say, what's an inactive ingredient, well, it may well be that the starches, the binders, the fillers, the parts of the pill that are not the molecule that is advertised are not important to most people. But if you have an allergy to one of those compounds, and any human person can be allergic to any number of different things in very, very idiosyncratic ways, there's always the chance for any individual person that this generic drug, although similar to the brand name drug in a general population, may be slightly different for them. At the same time, there's also the possibility, we now know that the placebo effect actually produces substantial difference in the effectiveness of medication, not in their efficacy, not in how they work in the clinical trial, but in how they work in real life. And so if someone believes that their medication has shifted and they see that the color of the pill has changed and they're worried that they're getting substandard medication, that process in and of itself can actually produce a form of difference.
Right. I mean, people are status seeking in general. And, you know, when we hear off brand, I don't think sometimes we react the same way as we would to something that was the one that cost more money.
It is a great point, Veronica. And one of the reasons I became so fascinated in this project is that researching the history of the generic is a way of researching what is the value of the brand. We can talk about this in terms of material differences and whether there is a difference in whether the chemical is bioavailable. But if all of that is the same, is there some other value of the brand that just takes on its own value? And I think in American medicine, there are many reasons to think that we have learned to value medicines by brand names in ways that makes it hard for us to then accept those chemicals in equivalent form later on.
Let's take another call here. We have Jeannie with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Two comments. One, from the perspective of the prescriber, I'm an eye doctor, and we are incredibly frustrated that there's many drugs that we used to prescribe routinely that are no longer on people's formularies, including generics. And when you prescribe the generic, sometimes it's $300, and it used to be $50. So that's been very frustrating. Many of the prices have been going up even on the generics. Number two, my second comment is, as a consumer, I've been on a popular blood pressure pill for years. It recently went generic. I started taking it, started getting headaches, took my blood pressure. Sure enough, my blood pressure had shot up, went back to the name brand, and it went back down. So, you know, that was my experience I take other drugs that are generics that are fine, but this particular one was not working, and had I not been on top of it, it could have had some serious consequences.
Okay, thanks a lot for your comments there, Jeannie. And what do you think about her comments, Jeremy?
So these are both very important points. I'd like to respond to both of them. Let me take the second one first. Here you're getting at this distinction, I would say, between reason and rationality. So the FDA works in rationality. It accumulates the data it can from populations and makes decisions about comparability based on that. That's really based on a population level. At the same time, as an individual, if you notice that your circumstances are materially different in a way that coincide with you taking this drug and that go away when you shift back to the normal drug, it's hard to know whether that was a placebo effect or something else. It doesn't sound like a placebo effect, but it's hard to know. But at the same time, you have to reason with that. And as an individual, you have to work with that and understand that your priorities wind up being different in that case from the bureaucratic structure of your insurer or of the FDA. And physicians are oftentimes in a bind here because, on the one hand, we are advocates to our patients on an individual basis as a fiduciary relation. On the other hand, we want to help produce cost-effective medicine when possible and not let our patients get fleeced. So this is this tension, I would say, between the individual reason and the more bureaucratic rationality, and generic drugs are suspended between those two. To take a second to your first question, because it is such an important question, I think your point illustrates some of the problems that we are now facing, given that we have embraced the generic drug market as a private sector solution to the public health problem of affordable access, right? We've tended to naturalize the generic drug as a sort of second life of a drug. The first life is a patent-protected stage when a new drug can be available at very high prices through a monopoly through its innovator. The belief then is that recoup of investment from the innovative company is made up for by the time the patent ends, and as soon as the patent ends, then generic competition will swoop in, drive the price down, and actually make medications more affordable and available. And the subtitle of my book is Generic, the Unbranding of Modern Medicine. It illustrates what happens in that process. And yet there's this process of rebranding of medicines that take place as well. Medicines that were generically available by many competitors with a low price that are now only available from one at a very high price. So this private sector solution can fail. One example is doxycycline, which is an old antibiotic, which in my training in internal medicine residency was often offered to us as a forgotten but very reasonable, older, generically available, cheap drug available at pennies a pill. And it now costs about $150 to get a supply because it's only available from one manufacturer. So we have these holes in the generic market, these ways in which that promise begins to break down that really need to be studied very closely.
And let's go next to Sarah, who joins us from Dubuque. Hi, Sarah.
Yes, hi. My question is do the excipients or fillers vary enough between the generic and name brand drugs to make a difference in their performance on the biochemical level?
Okay, good question, Sarah. What about that?
So this, again, gets at this question about what is the science of similarity. If the regulatory structure, if the scientific protocols the FDA use don't mandate equivalence or can't mandate absolute equivalence, as in the 100% concept that an earlier caller mentioned, how do we know what matters? And as a historian as well as a physician, I have to insist that how we know what matters changes over time when the sciences of similarity that we believe to be sufficient to guarantee therapeutic equivalence break down and show us that something we thought was unimportant or inert can actually be important. And there are many different places along the way in the last half century that unknown unknowns, things that we, and I would say we, I mean the entire scientific, regulatory, medical collective, didn't recognize to actually be important forms of difference, became evident as important forms of difference. And in a way, your question about, well, what if an excipient matters? Well, as soon as an excipient matters, the FDA then has to regulate it. But up till the point that nobody knows it matters, there's this question always that lurks within generic drugs of, are there unknown unknown differences that we are not yet knowledgeable enough to attend to?
Well, as a physician and someone who studied this, what should consumers know to take care of themselves when they're looking at generic drugs or brand name drugs?
I would encourage listeners to have a broad sense that the FDA is working very hard to ensure the therapeutic equivalence of generic and brand name drugs, and that those cost savings that occur when multiple generic competitors compete to produce an effective medicine at a lower price is really important to actually having a functional healthcare system. At the same time, we are all an N of one, and when there is a problem with a specific medication, I think the patient really needs to work with their physician to try to understand whether they happen to be an exception. And even though there are many bureaucratic structures that help incent generic substitution, from legal structures to economic structures to the nature of insurance reimbursement, a health provider always has a fiduciary responsibility to their individual patient to try and advocate for them if they are exceptional, and if for some reason what works for the general public is not working for them.
Great. Well, we're going to leave it there. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this today.
Thank you, Veronica. It's been a pleasure.
That was Jeremy Green, author of Generic, The Unbranding of Modern Medicine. He joined us back in September to talk about the rise of generic drugs in the United States and what it could mean for the future of healthcare.
Coming up next, a writer tries to get to the bottom of how Americans became a nation of positive thinkers and how one simple idea changed modern life forever. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll hear about a growing trend on social media called the baby blackout, meaning pics and videos of babies on sites like Facebook and Instagram are strictly off limits. We'll find out why it's catching on.
First, Americans tend to be known around the world for our positive thinking. We're the place where Oprah gained millions of viewers with her encouragement to be our best selves, and bookstores are filled with self-help advice.
Even political messages like "Yes, we can" enforce the idea that anything we put our minds to is possible. But how do we get to be a nation of positive thinkers?
Earlier this year, we spoke to Mitch Horowitz, author of One Simple Idea: How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. In the book, he tried to get a firm answer to that question. We started the interview by asking him how central positivity and positive thinking is to American culture today.
It's really central to American culture. If it wasn't for the positive thinking movement, however we come down on it, we wouldn't feel like ourselves. You know, some of the best-known expressions in American life derive from positive thinking, whether it's "yes, we can," or "just do it," "be all you can be," "nothing is impossible." We talk in these terms, and without the positive thinking movement, our culture would look and sound very different.
Where did that come from in our history?
It really started in the mid-19th century in New England with a movement called the Mental Healing Movement, or the Mind Cure Movement. American medicine was in terrible condition for much of the 19th century. In fact, our medicine lagged behind the medical sciences in Europe. It was probably the one consistent area where development in the U.S. lagged behind Europe. And people were desperate for alternatives, so they began to look to prayer therapy and autosuggestion and what would later come to be known as hypnotism and try to find ways of healing themselves. And many thousands of people decided that it worked and sought to use the mind as an agency to improve other areas of life, like career and finance and relationships.
And where did it go from there in terms of, you know, the medical claims? In general, you know, Americans, we are positive. Sometimes we're a skeptical lot, and we like there to be proof. Is there proof in the pudding that positive thinking works?
Well, most of the proof from that time was testimonial and anecdotal. It was interesting. You know, there were people who reported chores by using mental cure methods, and there were people who were struck by terrible tragedy by not seeking out standard medical care. It's just that standard medical care at the time was so poor, it was difficult proving whether it would have done any good, you know, had it been sought out, rather than using Christian Science methods, which was a religion that came out of the mental healing movement, or other forms of what was then known as mind cure. By the late 19th century, particularly with the opening of Johns Hopkins University Medical School, medicine got a lot better in this country, and by the 1890s, people weren't as desperate. There wasn't the same need to seek out alternative cures, although there were lots of them. Homeopathy, botanical remedies, and other things grew out of that era. But the country was changing, and the economy was really growing, and people were very eager and anxious to join the growing economy, and some of the people in the mental healing movement at that time, late 1880s, early 1890s, began to pioneer what later became known as the prosperity gospel, in which you would think and grow rich, as the expression goes.
Moving ahead a little bit, when I hear the phrase positive thinking, I think of The Power of Positive Thinking by Reverend Norman Vincent Peale. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, I wasn't around when it came out, but this is a book that was all over the place in, what was it, the early 50s, 1950s?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You really can't exaggerate that book's impact. When that book came out in 1952, it became the best-selling book that had ever been published in America, with the exception of the Bible. I mean, it was a book that you would just find in every household. It's still quite popular today. And the author, Norman Vincent Peale, was a Methodist minister who grew up in Ohio. And during the Great Depression, he was placed in charge of a congregation on Manhattan's east side, a Dutch Reformed congregation. And Peale was politically and culturally a very conservative guy, but religiously, he was a great experimenter. And he was willing to look into all kinds of different methods, many of which had to do with positive thinking metaphysics. There were movements that ranged from Christian Science to New Thought, which was really the movement that the mental cure had morphed into. And Peale just experimented and looked everywhere. He was had an early interest in the thought of the psychologist Carl Jung. He was interested in the ideas of William James and the Transcendentalists. And Peale came to feel that the positive thinking thesis, which is that our thoughts are causative, could be supported by statements in Scripture. And so he proceeded to write The Power of Positive Thinking, and he made positive thinking into a household term.
Is there something that smacks of first world privilege about positive thinking at all, that you actually have the time to read these books and devote your time to thinking positively instead of, you know, working hard to earn money and put food on the table?
Yes, and that's a real flaw of the positive thinking movement. I think there has been value in this movement, but it became an American movement because ours for many generations was an expanding country, an expanding economy, and even though there were great differences and inequities and imbalances in wealth, we at least could have the ideal that the individual could raise him or herself up. And Americans believed in that, wanted to believe in that. And the fact is, you know, today you will find a positive thinking movement in America that touches every corner of the nation. And obviously, you're not going to find the same thing on other continents or in other nations where there's a great deal of poverty, where people are locked in a daily struggle to survive. To some extent, ours is a movement of geography, and I encourage people in the positive thinking movement to be cognizant of things like that, because positive thinking in America grew up hand in hand, partly because of the circumstances of America as a nation.
You raise some concerns throughout the book with the way the positive thinking movement has evolved, affected people, but by and large, it seems, looking at your book, like you're sympathetic to it. What's the positive side of positive thinking as you see it?
I am sympathetic to it. I criticize it a great deal, but I feel that the critics, while I will walk down the road with them a long way, they don't look closely enough at some of the possibilities that have emerged from this movement. Right now, we're in the midst of some really interesting studies into the placebo effect, something that we've known about for a long, long time, but that I think we are producing some really interesting new data in, and studies that are coming out of Harvard and UCLA and other medical schools. I think that the people in the positive thinking movement, first of all, they had a rough early idea of a genuine connection between our mood and our sense of physical well-being that I think has been borne out in part by placebo studies, by mind-body medicine, by the familiarity with which we talk about stress-related disease today, whether it be hypertension or ulcers or chronic back or neck or shoulder pain. There's a realization that stress and mood plays a genuine role in our lives. And I also think that within cognitive psychology, psychology, the recovery groups, support groups, the 12-step approach to addiction recovery. You have principles and ideas from the positive thinking movement. People very rarely refer back to that movement as an antecedent. But the positive thinkers, although they were using a religious language in the 19th century, they were really struggling with a very rough early conception of what later came to be known as the subconscious mind or the unconscious mind. And I think their efforts amounted to something.
I want to talk about what's been a bit of a centerpiece in the world of positive thinking, and that is this movie called The Secret, which
yes.
became kind of a runaway hit. It had roots, though, that went back far earlier. Can you tell us about that and where it came from?
Sure. One of the most ironic aspects of The Secret is that when it became popular in 2006, 2007, it directed people's attention to some of the old positive thinking classics. And one of the books that the movie repeatedly extolled and that became very popular was a book called The Science of Getting Rich by a man named Wallace D. Wattles, who had been a Methodist minister and a longtime exponent of what was known as the social gospel. What many of the people who rediscovered Wattles' books didn't realize is that he was a socialist through and through. He ran for Congress and for local offices in Indiana on the Socialist Party ticket of Eugene V. Debs. He was an absolute social progressive and radical who believed at the time that some of these avant-garde religious methods, like the metaphysics of the mind, could help smooth out imbalances in wealth. And if you read The Science of Getting Rich carefully and you kind of have a map of what you're looking for, there's unmistakable socialist and Marxist language in it. And when this book was republished in 2007, it went to the number one spot on the Business Week bestseller list, and it was the centerpiece of The Nation. Of The Secret. It is basically a metaphysical expression of some of the ideas that came out of the social gospel, which was a radical Christian movement that translated the ethics of Christ into a conception of an equitable society, a socially just society. And that was an ironic early part of the development of the prosperity gospel. The prosperity gospel today is associated with mega churches and business motivation, but a lot of the early exponents of it actually believed that metaphysics along with social protest could be a way of creating a more equitable society.
Well, that seems weird to me because a socialist perspective you'd think would be community-oriented, group-oriented,
right.
collective, where I think of The Secret as an individual. How am I going to make myself rich? I don't know The Secret,
right.
but that's the gist, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, back in the day in the progressive era, there was an expression of socialism that was kind of more utopian. There was a novel, Looking Backward, by a man named Edward Bellamy, and he saw this world of mass luxury and plenty and leisure, and that was the vision that Wallace Wattles was coming out of. That vision by the 1930s and 40s disappeared from the positive thinking movement, so it translated more into what you do see in our time in The Secret, which is more of a radically individualist vision.
That's writer Mitch Horowitz talking about how America became a nation of positive thinkers.
We'll have the second half of that conversation in just a moment. First, a look at the headlines from WPR News.
We're talking right now with Mitch Horowitz. He's vice president and editor-in-chief at Penguin Tarcher Imprint. And we're talking about his book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
Well, Mitch, I want to get into the world of Oprah nowadays. She helped promote The Secret, which we were talking about a little bit there. How has Oprah affected how we think about positive thinking and inspirational messages these days?
Well, she brought many metaphysical books into people's living rooms, and in a certain sense, Oprah was almost, someone would have become Oprah. You know, it was an inevitable phenomenon. Because
if Oprah didn't exist, we'd have to invent her.
Exactly, and we would have. Really, every strain of self-help or therapeutic thought in this country intersects with the positive thinking idea, which is that our thoughts, in some measure or another, determine outcome. And Oprah was this enormously articulate person who was able to capture a therapeutic outlook that has really run throughout our country for a long, long time. When Ronald Reagan was first running for president, he would routinely say in his speeches, nothing is impossible. And Americans were able to connect with that because of generations of motivational psychology. Other presidents just didn't sound that way. Dwight Eisenhower didn't sound that way. Richard Nixon didn't sound that way. But after Reagan, every president had to sound that way. So when Obama was giving his State of the Union address in 2011. He uttered the line, "This is a country where anything is possible." And it was a leaf directly out of Reagan. So we all talk that way to a greater or lesser extent. And those of us who think, oh, gee, that's just shallow and superficial, you'll catch yourself every now and then actually using that phraseology. It's just in the groundwater of our country.
What does the brain research have to say about all this? If we hear a message, you know, from Ronald Reagan, anything's impossible, nothing's impossible, are there certain areas of our brain that just light up and get happy?
Well, there has been some interesting brain research at UCLA recently that touches on all this. There's an emerging field called neuroplasticity, in which researchers have found through brain scans that the actual redirection of your thoughts through certain ritualistic patterns can result in a change in the neural pathways, the pathways in which neurons fire in your brain. So, for example, this has implications for treating people who suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder. Researchers have found that if people can actively and sustainably redirect their thoughts away from certain ritualistic behaviors, eventually, in cases of OCD, that will result in redirected neural pathways in the brain. And this is a promising field. So, you know, we do have some evidence within a certain window of study that shows that, our thoughts and our thought patterns do have some biologic implications for the brain.
We've got some callers who want to weigh in on this now. We'll go to Lee first in Barron County. Lee, hi.
Hi. When I first heard you talking and your guest talking, I was like, oh, I've been there. I've done that. I used to belong to a church years ago. This would have been in the 1980s, affiliated with the Unity School of Christianity, they're called.
Sure.
And they're very much part of this turn-of-the-century movement that you were talking about. My understanding is that they were basically an offshoot of Christian Science. And what I always called them, for people who didn't understand, was I would tell them it was Christian Science Light. You were allowed to go to the doctor. it served me well in some ways. What I really liked about it was that they, a critical mass of their ministers are women.
Mm-hmm.
About 40-45%, which is was astonishing to me, and that really appealed to me. So I was affiliated with the church for a number of years, but what ended up making me leave it was I was suffering from, at the time, I know this now, but I didn't really understand it then, from clinical depression. And the positive thinking, the as you think, you will become kind of theology, had me in a funk, and it was making the depression worse, actually, that because I wasn't thinking the right thoughts, I wasn't able to heal myself. And as a result, I was staying miserable.
Lee, thanks so much. And is that a common criticism, Mitch, of positive thinking?
Yes, and that's a wonderful observation. And in fact, I start out the first chapter of my book quoting from a letter from a woman who sounds much like the caller, very deeply sensitive, intelligent person who attended a metaphysical positive thinking church. And she left disillusioned after several years because she was working as a coordinator for a group of women survivors of sexual abuse. And she said she could see both sides of it. She could see how a program of mental therapeutics, on one hand, could help a person, under the right circumstances, rebuild a sense of self. But on the other hand, could turn into this hectoring and sometimes almost victim-blaming dogma or approach. And she left. And my message to the people in the positive thinking movement, and I say this to them as a person who's inside their world, not outside their world, is that if you can't retain smart, sensitive people like that, this movement is not going to maintain a congregational structure. You know, I think the positive thinking movement has got to get away from this one overarching idea, which is featured in The Secret, that our thoughts are this kind of super law that we all live under. We live under many factors and forces, and the caller was pointing out she was experiencing clinical depression. She needed medical care. She needed medical attention. The positive thinking movement has got to accommodate itself to the complexity of people's lives.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Lee. And let's move on to Monica joining us from Greenfield. Hi there.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was not exposed to the positive thinking as a theology, so I couldn't say much about that. But I think it reminds me of my mother. We grew up Catholic, very devoted Catholic, but she had she has a still a very positive way of looking at life. And she used to tell us when we were growing up, especially the girls, if you frown at your hair, you are for sure going to have a bad hair day. And her attitude was always one of, there are going to be problems in life. As I said, being a Catholic, we believe that God is in the driver's seat, but we still have the option of buckling up or not. And to take problems and be a part of the solution, not the problem. So your call reminds me of that. It's such a lighter way of seeing it, not as a theology or a religion.
So it sounds, Monica, like this is something you were okay growing up with, it because it taught you that you could maybe have some choice, some volition about the way you thought about the world.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Monica.
Yeah, I'm in great sympathy with what she said. You know, too often we hear these things and we think, oh, you know, don't tell me to have a nice day. It sounds so, you know, it sounds sometimes to people like it's immature or it's a sort of forced cheerfulness. But those ideas can go deeper and can represent more in a person's life than we sometimes understand. My mother-in-law is a devout Catholic, and she recently retired from a position as an associate dean at Harvard Medical School, a very accomplished person, and in many respects a very self-made person in the truest sense. She's absolutely dedicated to all kinds of positive thinking ideas and literature, and she has postcards and little business card-sized signs hanging up throughout her apartment that have all these positive thinking affirmations on them. And, you know, to the outsider, these things can sometimes seem like a forced display of cheerfulness. But for some people, they really do make a difference. They can flick a switch at certain sensitive moments that help an individual get through a stress or get through a difficulty of the day.
Mitch, looking toward the future, we've seen a lot of commentary over the years that we're getting more cynical. We're maybe more negative than we used to be. Do you see cynicism crowding out positive thinking in the United States?
I do, actually. The kind of discourse that goes on online and in texts and social postings, tweets and such, tends to be very, very coarse, and it's just endemic to our society. I think, actually, we are going through a really deep and substantial coarsening of our communication, and we as individuals are all going to have to take a look at that, because it's going to reach a point of irreversibility where rudeness and cynicism and sarcasm just becomes quite normal. And it's very different from the kind of correspondence that people conducted, say, 30, 40 years ago. One of the reasons, among many, that the positive thinking movement grew to popularity in the early 19th century is that the economy was changing from an agricultural to an industrial and corporate base. People were flowing into jobs in large offices and professional workplaces for the very first time. They didn't always know how to act, what proper decorum was, what proper communication was. To an extent, there are positive thinking books that people sometimes make fun of today, like Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People, but those books answered a certain need. They helped people understand what was expected of them in terms of decorum in professional atmospheres. We are going to have to relearn those lessons in the digital age, because the degree, I believe, of cynicism and coarseness over digital communication is really becoming suffocating.
Mitch, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was Mitch Horowitz, author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life.
Coming up next, should we share pictures of our babies, our kids, on social media, sites like Facebook? Our guest says maybe it's time for a baby blackout. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.